This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Kevin speaking at Clark College in Vancouver.
PDX Pop Now returns for their 2013 festival from July 19th to July 21st, located at East Bank Lot on the corner of Southeast Water and Salmon. It's an all-ages event showcasing Portland's incredibly diverse musical talent. Bringing the festival to two outdoor stages for the very first time, the three-day event will feature 45 bands, a food court, activity area, Riggs Ball, a street fair, and even more, making this the biggest and most interactive festival experience yet in the history of this event. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 11 a.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, the Digital Divide. Welcome to the Digital Divide. This is your host, Rabia Yeaman, and today I'll be bringing you some updates on Edward Snowden and the NSA spying scandal. We'll also hear from Glenn Greenwald, the American political commentator who interviewed Snowden, and get an update on Snowden's status. We'll also be hearing an interview with Dr. Neil Barnard, clinical researcher, author, and health advocate. He's been the principal investigator and co-investigator on several clinical trials on the effects of diet and health. He'll be talking to us about the foods that we eat and their relationship to mitigating Alzheimer and other diseases of the brain. He just recently came out with a new book, and we'll be talking to him about primarily, most really interesting is metals in our vitamins and foods that we eat and their relationship to Alzheimer's. So that would be minerals. So we're going to start by just talking about the country of Colombia has asked the U.S. for explanation after reports it was targeted by NSA spying, and Venezuela was also a target of U.S. spying revealed in whistleblower Edward Snowden's revelations.
NSA was not just prying into the private lives of Americans. Brazil, Colombia, Mexico, and other Latin American countries were allegedly being monitored as well. According to Brazilian media sources, the NSA worked with Brazilian telecommunications companies to engage in surveillance operations and to gather data. The NSA allegedly focused on military and security data to keep an eye on rebels with ties to Iran. And that's not all. The agency is accused of spying on state-controlled industries in Venezuela as well.
In the event you have been away from all media or are confused by the official media spin, former CIA employee Edward Snowden has come forward as the whistleblower behind the explosive revelations about the NSA U.S. surveillance state. The 29-year-old left his job inside the NSA's office in Hawaii, where he worked for the private intelligence firm Booz Allen Hamilton, after distributing NSA documents showing the U.S. spying not only on you and I, but all U.S. citizens and other countries as well. Through the web, telecommunication companies including Microsoft, Google, AT&T, Verizon, and many more. His last location... known location was the airport in Russia after leaving Hong Kong. He doubts he will ever see his home again. In a video interview with The Guardian of London, Snowden says he exposed top-secret NSA surveillance programs to alert Americans of expansive government spying on innocents. Even if you're not doing anything wrong, Snowden says, you're being watched and recorded. And the storage capability of these systems increases every year, consistently by orders of magnitude.
Companies like Google, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, they all get together with the NSA and provide the NSA direct access to the back ends of all of the systems you use to communicate, to store data, to put things in the cloud, and even just to send birthday wishes and keep a record of your life. And they give NSA direct access that they don't need to oversee, so they can't be held liable for it. I think that's a dangerous capability for anybody to have, but particularly an organization that's demonstrated time and time again that they'll work to shield themselves from oversight. The primary disclosures are the fact that the NSA doesn't limit itself to foreign intelligence. It collects all communications that transit the United States. There are literally no ingress or egress points anywhere in the continental United States where communication there enter or exit without being monitored and collected and analyzed. On top of that, you've got boundless informant, which is sort of a global auditing system for the NSA's intercept and collection system that lets us track how much we're collecting, where we're collecting, by which authorities and so forth. The NSA lied about the existence of this tool to Congress and to specific congressmen in response to previous inquiries about their surveillance activities.
Edward Snowden, in his own words. Glenn Greenwald is an American political commentator, lawyer, columnist, blogger, and author. He has been a columnist for the U.S. edition of The Guardian since August 2012. Prior to that, he was a columnist for Salon.com and an occasional contributor to The Guardian. Greenwald is currently linked to Edward Snowden in exposing President Obama's NSA spying on American scandal. Greenwald appeared on the July 8th DemocracyNow.org talking again about Snowden.
I'm Amy Goodman as we bring you part two of our discussion with the Guardian columnist and blogger Glenn Greenwald, also a constitutional lawyer, talking about the unfolding saga around Edward Snowden, the former U.S. intelligence contractor who leaked documents about U.S. secret domestic and global surveillance programs. Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua have offered Snowden asylum, the decision coming after the Bolivian president was forced to land in Austria after France and Portugal barred it from their airspace over false suspicions that Snowden was on board. I wanted to turn to a moment on CNN's Piers Morgan last month when Morgan asked Alan Dershowitz, the attorney and Harvard professor, if anything Glenn Greenwald has done as a journalist borders on criminality. This was Dershowitz's response.
Well, it doesn't border on criminality. It's right in the heartland of criminality. The statute itself does punish the publication of classified material if you know that it's classified. And so Greenwald, in my view, clearly has committed a felony. And for him to take umbrage at the question. Now, he's right, though, that the government doesn't usually go after the publishers. They don't go after the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Pentagon Papers case, though they could have. They don't go after other newspapers in the WikiLeaks case, though they could have. They've made a discretionary decision to go after the leaker, but not the publisher. But look, Greenwald's a total phony. He is anti-American. He loves tyrannical regimes. And he did this because he hates America. This had nothing to do with publicizing information.
That's Attorney Alan Dershowitz. Glenn Greenwald, your response.
Well, first of all, it's really quite amusing that somebody who poses as a civil libertarian would go on CNN and say that journalists are committing felonies by reporting on what the government is doing. Almost as funny as a journalist like David Gregory, a self-professed journalist like David Gregory, making the same sort of suggestion. And I mean, look, Alan Dershowitz is one of the country's most bloodthirsty radicals. He advocated for torture warrants. He supports all forms of Israeli aggression. If I weren't being attacked by the Alan Dershowitz of the world, I'd be genuinely concern, and all that really is about is some personal resentment over his effort to censor a BDS boycott, divestment, and sanctions event at Brooklyn College, and I defended Brooklyn College's academic freedom, and we won, and he lost, and he's still bitter. But you know, the broader point that he's trying to make is essentially that if you shine light on what the United States government is doing in the dark, that somehow makes you anti-American. And to me, everything about the Constitution is devoted to checking and limiting abuses of power by the United States government. That's why the freedom of the press is guaranteed in the First Amendment. It's a pure vindication of what are supposed to be the defining American values to do the kind of reporting that we're doing.
Ask you about President Maduro of Venezuela reproaching the United States for offering asylum to Cuban exile and former CIA operative Luis Posada Carriles, who's wanted in Venezuela for the bombing of the Cubana Airlines jet that killed 73 people. This is what he said.
Who is the terrorist? A government like us who seeks to serve the young Snowden, a figure of humanitarian asylum from persecution by the American Empire, or the United States government that protects with political asylum Luis Posada Carriles, a confessed convicted murderer and terrorist who is wanted by Venezuela for the bombing of the Cubana plane in 1976.
That's the Venezuelan President Maduro. Your response to that that comparison, Glenn, of Posada Carriles in the United States and Edward Snowden?
Well, I mean, it's amazing that the minute any country thinks about giving asylum to somebody whom the United States has declared to be a bad person, that country instantly gets viciously attacked by the American government, its media servants, and people who support government conduct. It is true that Venezuela has certain serious imperfections in its political system, as do most countries around the world, probably all countries around the world. But it's also true that the United States, if you want to talk about things like supporting terrorism, supporting violence around the world and the like, has at least as bad of a record, and I think you could argue a much worse record. And the United States government has continuously sheltered all kinds of people that other countries around the world have viewed quite justifiably and reasonably as being criminals and who they wanted to be returned to their countries to prosecute them in their courts. And the position of the United States government has long been that asylum is a well-recognized right in international law, and if someone is being persecuted by the court system or by the government with unjust prosecution, that they will, the United States will shield them. And apparently a lot of people think that this is a right that only the United States has, but no other country, and that isn't how international law or human rights functions. And if you want to say that the United States has the right to give asylum to people who are wanted by other countries, then other countries have that same right.
Let me ask you about Edward Snowden right now. We believe, is this correct, that he's still at the airport in Moscow?
Yeah, I actually had the opportunity to speak with him for the first time on Saturday, the first time since he left Hong Kong. I had a good long conversation with him. And although I'm not interested in divulging where he is, he, you know, is enthused about the developments over the last week, both in terms of ongoing revelations and the ongoing debate that he hoped to trigger about surveillance policy worldwide, as well as the support that he's getting from around the world and from, as of the moment, three different governments who have all independently offered him asylum. So the question of how he's going to get there, what's going to happen once he arrives, those are still in the process of being worked out. But he's doing very well in terms of his mindset, his demeanor. He's able to follow things online, the debates as they unfold, and he's feeling very good about the choices that he made.
Did he talk about his preference for where he wants to go?
He didn't. I didn't really speak very much with him about his quest for asylum. I think that he has always been fairly consistent about the fact, and there's a fantastic article, an op-ed by Daniel Ellsberg in the Washington Post today, making the same point, that the crucial objective that Snowden has, just like Ellsberg had, was to make sure that he's able to participate in the ongoing debate that he triggered. And that means staying out of the custody of the United States government, which will not only put him in prison, but render him incommunicado. And so I think wherever he ends up, as long as it's somewhere that he can be heard and his voice can be heard, I think he'll be happy and fine.
What, Glenn, is Edward Snowden most encouraged by as he follows the debates and the continued revelations online?
The very first conversation I ever had with him, Amy, online, he said that his only fear, he only had one fear, and that was that he would sacrifice his life and take these enormous personal risks in order to make these disclosures possible and then have the world react with indifference and apathy, a kind of fear that they would just simply say, okay, well, I assume this was happening and I don't really mind. None of that has happened. There's been an incredibly intense debate inside the United States over these disclosures, all kinds of movements of reform, movements against the United States government, and in many, many other countries around the world, as we previously discussed. So he feels like what he set out to do is exactly what has happened. He said he didn't set out to destroy these systems. That's not his place. He set out to make people around the world realize what the United States' government is doing to them to enable them to decide whether that's the kind of thing they're willing to tolerate. He sees those debates happening, and he's extremely enthused and satisfied that his objective has been fulfilled.
His father has been pushing for him to come back to the United States and be tried. Does Ed Snowden share those sentiments?
I think that the father is concerned as a father. I actually had the opportunity to speak with his lawyer, Bruce Fine, several days ago, and is doing what a parent, most parents would do, which is simply trying to do what's best for their children. But I think the premise of that view, that he ought to come back to the United States, is one that Mr. Snowden vehemently rejects, and I think with good reason, which is that the United States judicial system is trustworthy and reliable to give a fair trial. The record of the United States judiciary since the 9/11 attacks is shameful and atrocious. It pretty much is an instantly subservient vessel whenever the United States government raises claims that national security has been harmed. They cheat in cases when there are Muslim defendants accused of terrorism. They make up new rules. They do everything they can to ensure conviction and that the government gets everything that it wants. They've done that in cases more broadly about national security. And so if you're Edward Snowden and you know the U.S. government is going to accuse you of espionage, that Justice Department prosecutors are going to be telling federal judges that you've severely endangered national security, oftentimes prosecutors don't even have to tell the judges what basis they have for those claims. Oftentimes they cite documents that the judges don't even need to see. The judges are almost in every instance squarely on the side of the government. So if we had a system the way it was supposed to work, which is where the judiciary was a check on prosecutorial abuse and gave a fair trial, I think he would be willing to come back. But since nobody thinks that, or at least a lot of people don't, and Daniel Ellsberg made this point today in the Washington Post when he defended Snowden's decision to flee, saying that it was a much different country than it was 40 years ago when he went to court, I think that the chances that he's going to come back to the U.S. Voluntarily is extremely low.
Are you concerned, Glenn, about coming back into the United States as you have revealed all of these stories of Edward Snowden, the revelations?
When you have major political figures like the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee and prominent establishment journalists publicly calling for your arrest and prosecution and debating whether or not you should be prosecuted as kind of a mainstream debate now, of course it would be irrational to dismiss the concern and just simply ignore it. At the same time, I know that I've committed no crime, that I have the full right under the First Amendment to engage in freedom of the press. And so I have lawyers who are working on the situation, and I have every intention to come back to the United States when I'm ready to do that.
Glenn, you tweeted on Saturday, Edward Snowden confirmed to me today that the statement released by WikiLeaks was written exclusively by Snowden. Tell us what that statement was.
He essentially had issued a statement through WikiLeaks that was somewhat, I guess you could say, rhetorically virulent in its tone, and a little bit more so than I had been accustomed to hearing him, in which he was very angry at the Obama administration for President Obama first coming out and saying that we won't do anything extreme, like scramble fighter jets to take down the plane of a 29-year-old hacker, as Obama dismissively called him, only then to essentially do the equivalent of that, which is getting U.S. allies to block the plane that they thought he was on from flying over their airspace and forcing it to land in a completely different country. He was essentially, and the main point that he made, I think, is the critical one, which is that the U.S. government no longer fears Edward Snowden, just like they don't fear Bradley Manning, because Bradley Manning already did all of his leaks. Mr. Snowden has already made sure that the documents that he took will eventually be revealed in a responsible way. They're not afraid of them. What they're afraid about is two things. One, that future whistleblowers will be inspired by their example to come forward and blow the whistle on secret wrongdoing, illegality, and deceit. And secondly, that the American people will become informed about what the U.S. government is doing in the dark and their name and against them. And that's the reason that they're so desperate and extreme in what they're trying to do to Edward Snowden, not because they're trying to stop him from doing anything in the future. He's already done what he's going to do. It's because they want to make sure that the American people, that's the real enemy, don't learn what it is that they ought to know about what their government is doing in the dark. And that was the point that he made in his statement.
What about Edward Snowden's change, how his feelings have changed over the years? You know, this statement in 2009 that people have reported on, Snowden's leaking the NSA documents, appears to have come after a major change of heart on the issue of government whistleblowers. In an online chat from 2009 released by Ars Technica this week, someone using Snowden's screen name criticized the disclosure of classified government information, saying those who do so should be shot. The criticism came in response to a New York Times article based on leaked information about U.S. cyber attacks on Iran, Glenn.
Well, I think a lot of people change their views over the course of years after taking more information in. Certainly people who are younger, I think, are more prone to do that. That's a healthy intellectual evolution. But, you know, we're actually going to release a new video showing excerpts of the interview that Laura Poitras and I did with him in Hong Kong on June 6th, later today, in which part of the excerpt is him discussing the evolution. Remember, this is somebody who grew up in a military community in Virginia. Both of his parents worked for the United States government. When he was 21 or 22, he went and joined the U.S. Army in 2004 because he thought he wanted to fight in the Iraq War, because he thought it was a noble effort to liberate people from oppression. He then spent the next 6, 7, 8 years of his adult life working for the CIA and the NSA. So this isn't somebody born to a radical anti-American household or who was inculcated with the idea that the U.S. government is evil. Quite the opposite. He began thinking the U.S. government was the most noble government in the world and wanted to work and devote his career to supporting its policies. And it was only over time, gradually, that he began seeing all sorts of things and thought critically about them, just like Bradley Manning did, who joined the U.S. military with the same thoughts and only gradually began to see it as a force for evil. That is Mr. Snowden's evolution as well. And he finally got to the point where he realized that so much was going on that the American public was unaware of, that they were being propagandized so deceitfully, just like he had been propagandized, that he felt like he could no longer in good conscience allow that to continue. And so, of course, there's all sorts of things in his past where he expressed political views that he no longer believes and even vehemently renounces. That's true for me. That's true for all sorts of people who have a critical and open mind and who evolve in their political views. And to try and use that, as it's been done, to suggest that somehow that's strange or that undermines or impugns his motives, I think is completely irrational. To me, it really confirms and corroborates the purity of the motives that he's claiming.
And finally, Glenn, it's not only the revelations that you have put out in The Guardian and that have come out other places, but they're sparking even others, I think, to go down this track. The latest NSA spying issue, another headline today, U.S. Postal Service now under scrutiny for a surveillance program of its own. The New York Times revealing the Postal Service has been carrying out a mail isolation control and tracking program, which photographs every piece of mail in its system around 160 billion envelopes, packages, postcards documented last year. The contents never read without a warrant, but they allow investigators to learn key information, including names, addresses, return addresses, postmark locations. The information reportedly used to nab the suspect recently accused of mailing ricin-laced letters to Obama and New York Mayor Bloomberg. Leslie James Pickering, the former activist with the Earth Liberation Front, who now owns a small bookstore in Buffalo, recently learned his mail was being monitored after a surveillance order was accidentally delivered to his door. Can you respond to this?
There's a fantastic article by the journalism professor at NYU, Jay Rosen, who has written a article entitled The Snowden Effect. And what he argues is that the revelations about the surveillance state go far beyond the specific revelations enabled by the documents that he disclosed to us that we're now disclosing to the world. In our reporting, that instead he completely refocused, Snowden did, worldwide global attention on the abuses of the surveillance state. And so not just that article about the Postal Service monitoring, but the one you mentioned earlier about the FISA court. There's articles in Le Monde last week about how the French are mass surveilling their own citizens' electronic communications, all sorts of revelations coming forward. One in the Washington Post today about how the Pentagon is engaged in domestic propaganda, monitoring websites for what they consider to be extremist political activity. This tidal wave of revelations that clearly have come from the sea change that has resulted in how we think about surveillance as a result of Mr. Snowden's whistleblowing and the reporting of ours that it enabled. And I think that that's really ultimately going to be the most profound effect. People are thinking differently about how their government spies on them, the nature of government secrecy, whether they want to trust their government, why journalism has failed to uncover these sorts of things, why we needed someone like Mr. Snowden to risk his life and throw away his liberty in order to come forward and bring it to our attention. I think this is all going to have very profound repercussions for a long time to come.
I'm Rabia Yemin for The Digital Divide. I'm joined today by Dr. Neil Barnard. Dr. Barnard is a nutrition researcher and adjunct associate professor of medicine at George Washington University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. He is president of the nonprofit Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine and the author of 15 previous books on diet and health. Dr. Barnard's newest book, Power Foods for the Brain, discusses nutrition's surprising effects on the brain and the diet changes that may help shield the brain from memory loss, stroke, and Alzheimer's. Welcome to The Digital Divide, Dr. Barnard.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Well, you have a new book, and it's called Power Foods for the Brain, and in it you tell us that certain foods and supplements could be contributing to Alzheimer's and that other foods we eat can and you use the word shield our brains and help protect against memory loss. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, that's right. Alzheimer's disease is an epidemic. And I have to say, when my father's parents developed Alzheimer's disease, we thought, that's old age. That's just the way it is. But it's not old age. It's a disease process that occurs, and it is so common. Nearly half of Americans get it by age 85. And it doesn't start then. It's the roots of it start earlier in life. And the only reason that people just sort of accept it is we always figured there wasn't anything you can do. It's part of getting older. It's maybe genetic. There isn't much that you can do.
I can't reverse it by drinking red wine.
Well, people have maybe hoped that a little wine might make a difference. And actually, wine does have a beneficial effect, although that's not quite it. But hopefully we can talk about that. But the good news is that not just wine, but many different food choices have quite dramatic effects on the brain. And studies have looked at large groups of people, and they have started to sort out who gets this disease, who doesn't get it, and what were they eating that can either increase the risk or decrease the risk. That literature, that scientific literature, has finally matured.
Is it real science, or is it, you know, people in a content mill churning out science-y sounding documents?
I think the most important of these is called the Chicago Health and Aging Project. And it was a group of researchers at Rush University Medical Center. And they brought in thousands and thousands of people. And they asked them what they were eating and tracked it in great detail. And then they just waited to see who developed dementia and who did not. And by the way, when I say dementia, I mean loss of memory and loss of mental functions. And the most common form is Alzheimer's disease. There are other forms too, like stroke or vascular dementia. Anyhow, what they discovered, well, first of all, was that certain kinds of fat in the foods that we eat, think of bacon grease, it's loaded with saturated fat. Think of cheese.
Sorry, burners.
Well, you know exactly what I'm talking about. When I was a kid, I grew up in Fargo, North Dakota, and we ate meaty diets, cheese, all that kind of thing. And so we were getting all this saturated fat. That's the solid fat. People who ate the most saturated fat had about 3 times the risk of Alzheimer's disease compared to the people who tended not to eat it. Then they looked at trans fats, the fats that are in donuts and snack foods, the partially hydrogenated oils, but we refer to them as trans fats. The people who ate the most of those had about 5 times the risk. And when those numbers became apparent, and then were supported by other research studies, one in New York, one in Finland, that had the same kind of result, researchers were horrified because they thought, wait a minute, what happened with the fast food revolution? Everybody started eating burgers with cheese all over the top. And the reason cheese has that waxy, gooey feel is it's loaded with saturated fat, and the same with a burger, and the same with the fried chicken. And so the idea is, could those of us who were dining, you know, a couple of times a week at fast food restaurants when we were teenagers, early adults, are we set up for Alzheimer's disease? And the answer is yes. But the good news is that, as horrifying as that is, the silver lining is that you could choose what you're going to eat today. And if I decide I'm not going to be in that high fat group, I'm going to go low fat. In the same way as even a late inning change of diet will open up your arteries again. They might have been clogged by years of smoking, bad diets, and all that kind of thing. This is the work of Dr. Dean Ornish in San Francisco, where he showed you could take people who have got serious heart disease and you change their diet. You throw out all the meat.
I mean, he reverses it without surgery if they choose, if they do it.
Yeah. Vegetarian diet.
Amazing.
Vegetarian diet. No meat.
Right.
Throw out the animal products. Don't smoke. Try to manage stress, which is why he didn't do the study in Washington, D.C., where I live. And a little bit of exercise. And the arteries opened up again in 82% of people. And now we know that heart disease isn't part of getting older. It's a disease process that comes from eating that kind of food and smoking. The same is true with the brain. And in other words, let's say that right now, at the age I am now, I throw out the bad fats. There's much more that we can do, but let's say I just do that. I believe that will cut our risk of Alzheimer's to half or less. And we can do that today very, 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 very easily. So that's the good news. If you're somebody like me, all 4 of my grandparents developed this disease, and my father. When my father died a year ago, it was as if he had died mentally a decade earlier. My dad grew up on a cattle ranch in, well, North Dakota is not known for being the home of healthy eaters, and that's where I grew up. And my father left the cattle business.
Long winters.
I got it. You got it. My father went to medical school, and he spent his life as a physician treating diabetes in Fargo, but we ate like we were in the cattle business. And if I could go back in time and say, throw that out, you know, let's get to know things that we never ate. You know, we never had a veggie burger. We never had asparagus and, you know, these things were just afterthoughts, if that. But in the same...
They were garnish.
Yeah, they were garnish. They were never at the center of the plate. A meal wasn't a meal without meat. And my first job was under the Golden Arches.
Yeah. You're not alone there.
It's true for a lot of people.
You know, I have a question about fats, as long as we're kind of still on that subject. You know, it seems that the fat stays in our system because, I mean, heat melts fat. And so is the problem really that we're not moving? I know that ingesting those types of fats isn't healthy, but the fact that we're ingesting them and then we're just sitting or going into a food coma or whatever happens after we eat. And it gives those fats an opportunity to harden, as opposed to if we were moving, then we would be generating heat and melting them. Is that overly simplistic?
Well, I think you're touching on one of the problems with this kind of science is that we know what causes it. It's like the science of smoking. People knew that smokers had lung cancer. They didn't know why. What was it in the smoke? And they started teasing apart the various chemicals. And to this day, you could still argue about it. And so that's where we are with Alzheimer's disease and certain other forms of dementia. We know there's something about those fats, but what is it? One suspect is this mechanism by which eating those fats, the saturated fat in animal fat, and by the way, it's also in chicken, a surprising amount in chicken and even some in fish. As opposed to it is not in your bean burrito. It's not in the vegetables and fruits and that kind of thing. We know that they raise cholesterol levels. And researchers at Kaiser Permanente did a fascinating study. They looked at people's cholesterol levels, and then they looked at who developed Alzheimer's disease. And if your cholesterol was low, your risk was low. If your cholesterol was high, your risk was high. And if your cholesterol was sort of in the middle, then your risk was in the middle. But here was the thing. The cholesterol levels that they measured and that predicted Alzheimer's risk, the cholesterol levels they measured were when the people were around 40. And their Alzheimer's risk was when they were 70, 80. In other words, decades down the road. So how many of us at, say, 40 think, I really better take care of myself? Nobody does. We figure, later on, if I get heart problems, maybe I'll do something about it. You don't get your first gray hair when you're 75. You don't get your first wrinkle when you're 80 or 90.
Oh, right.
All of those things happen early. And the changes in the arteries start occurring when people are teenagers or even before. And what I'm suggesting is that the changes in the brain can start occurring early too. Now, it is never too early to take care of the most important organ in your body. And beyond that, it's also never too late, because we have seen studies on elderly people around 80 years old, where they're already starting to have memory problems, and they make certain diet adjustments that I can tell you about, and you see measurable changes in a very short period of time.
Is kale miracle food?
Well, kale is one of them. I got to tell you, when I was a kid in Fargo, I never heard of kale. I never heard of collard greens. That's like Southern food, as far as I knew. We had spinach once in a while if we had to, but green leafy vegetables...
Only in a can.
And by and large, the green leafy vegetables weren't our thing, but... Since you mentioned that, it's not just the bad fats getting away from them. There are certain good things. And the green leafy vegetables have folate, F-O-L-A-T-E. Folate is a B vitamin that protects the brain. And the name comes from foliage. So, for example, green leafy vegetables, spinach, kale, collards, broccoli, all of them, foliage, give you folate, this B vitamin. And it works in tandem with vitamin B6, which is in beans. It's also in bananas, as well as vitamin B12. Those three work together, and what they do is they are sort of the garbage men of the brain. They go into your brain. Your brain cells are working all the time, and just like the cells in the rest of your body. They produce, I'm going to call it factory waste. Just like a factory makes waste, you've got to get rid of it or it gunks up the machinery. Your cells of your body produce something called homocysteine. Homocysteine has to be removed. Otherwise, it's toxic to the heart. It's toxic to the brain. That's what the B vitamins do. So let's say you are a kale-avoiding person. You don't have the garbage men to get rid of it. So green leafy vegetables for folate. Beans, bananas for B6. And B12, by the way, really should come from a supplement. It's much more absorbable from supplements. That's my only supplement that I really think people should be taking, as opposed to getting your vitamins from foods. But well, they work together. They get rid of the garbage.
That's a great segue. Actually, you do write in your book about supplements and how some supplements you feel could actually be contributing to the problem by people ingesting metals through zinc and copper. Tell us a little bit about that, because people, every time we open up any kind of media, we're being told that if we take this supplement or we eat this food, it's going to help us. And there's so much of that information, some of it totally conflicting, that after a while you just feel like your head's going to explode, because you're saying to yourself, well, first of all, there's no way if I eat all of these things that I'm supposed to eat to be healthier, I'm going to be huge. You know, so you're just kind of left paralyzed, not really knowing what to do. And you don't want to go on fad, you know, taking fad supplements just because something is popular. So what do we do? What should we not take? You know, what will hurt us?
Okay, terrific question. First of all, let me lay out what I think is an ideal regimen. And first of all, it's foods. Foods are the key. And there are four food groups that should be on everybody's plate. And these are the essentials: vegetables, fruits, whole grains, and legumes, or the bean group. So vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans. Meat is not essential. Dairy is not essential. You're better off without them. But I would add one supplement I think everybody should take. That's vitamin B12, because it's much more absorbable from a supplement than from foods. Now, there are all kinds of other supplements. There are whole grocery store aisles devoted to them. And there are two problems that come up over and over again. The first is they put in things that you should not have. When we look into the brain of a person who died with Alzheimer's disease, what we see between the brain cells are little specks, microscopic, called amyloid plaque, little amyloid plaques. And when you tease apart the amyloid plaque, what you discover is it has iron in it, it has copper, it has zinc, it has aluminum in it. And we believe that it is damaging the brain. This is a hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. Well, where is that from? It maybe comes from cast iron pans, contribute iron. Aluminum cookware can contribute aluminum. But if you look at the label of your multiple vitamin, they threw iron and copper in there. But you need a certain amount of iron for healthy blood cells. You need copper for enzyme function. But you do not, you're already getting it from food. If they throw it into a multiple vitamin, you're getting too much. So that's my first indictment, is they throw in things you don't need. The second problem with many of these pills, let's say I want more vitamin E. Vitamin E is good. In research studies, people who get more vitamin E cut their risk of Alzheimer's by anywhere from 25 to 70%. However, those are studies done with foods. I'm talking about the vitamin E in sunflower seeds and sesame seeds and various nuts like walnuts and pecans and almonds. If you go to the store and you get a vitamin E pill, it does not have the whole range of different kinds of vitamin E that are in foods. There's a whole symphony of vitamin E's working together in food. There's one in your pill, maybe two. And if they pack one or two in, they can label it vitamin E and sell it to you. But when we see how they work in research studies, they don't work like the vitamin E in foods. So a healthy regimen is vegetables, fruits, whole grains, and legumes. And take a B12 supplement. I think that's a good idea. One more thing. If you are never outdoors and not getting sunlight, which is the natural form of vitamin B12, natural form of vitamin D, then you should take a vitamin D supplement. Up to about 2,000 IUs a day is safe.
You know, a lot of people in the Northwest really find that adding a vitamin D supplement, had like a remarkable effect. Like when you're kind of slowing down, you develop a new bar over a long period of time. And I started taking a vitamin D supplement. I felt like I had been injected with an energy, you know, magic energy sprinkles. It was unbelievable, the difference. So and actually my own physician had recommended 2,000 vitamin D a day, and it really was putting that out there, folks. For your winter, low energy thing.
That's right. Normally, vitamin D comes from sunlight on our skin, but we have, being such a restless species, we have gone an awful long way from the equator, which is where we're really supposed to be. So, if you spent your life around the equator and got sun all the time, you'd feel good and you would have the vitamin D that you need. But we have migrated to upper latitudes and cloudy areas, and so we're not getting the
vitamin D. The fifth floor. We've migrated to the fifth floor.
that's right. Now, you know, I said people should eat vegetables, fruits, whole grains, and beans. Those are ingredients. It doesn't sound like food. So I should probably mention what a day's meals might look like. So when I was a kid growing up in Fargo, it was bacon and eggs and sausage, and those are a mistake. Now, if you want sausage, have the veggie sausage. If you want bacon, have the veggie bacon. That's perfectly okay. But a bowl of oatmeal, and if you want to top it with blueberries and walnuts and slivered almonds and cinnamon, that's fine. If you have some pancakes, top them with some blueberries or crushed walnuts or something like that. Those are fine. For lunch, instead of the meat chili, have a bean chili. And in Power Foods for the Brain, I have the world's greatest white bean chili recipe that's very delicious, and it doesn't have any of the bad fats.
I happen to be a white bean enthusiast myself.
Oh, there you go. Well, you're going to like my chili. And if you go to a submarine sandwich place and they'll say, what kind of meat do you want? Say, no meat, no cheese. Give me the lettuce, tomatoes, spinach, cucumbers. Give me the olives or the avocado or whatever the case may be. Put some red wine vinegar on there. Toast it for me. Delicious. If you're at the taco place, skip the greasy meat taco. Have the bean burrito. Hold the cheese. Now, if let's say we went out to an Italian meal and I decided, all right, I want to have healthy foods, none of the bad fats, and it ought to be vegetarian. It ought to be vegan, really. What can I do? You can have the glass of red wine beforehand if you wish. Then have your nice salad, bowl of lentil soup or minestrone or pasta fagioli. When your angel hair pasta arrives, top it not with the meat sauce or the cream sauce, but top it with artichoke hearts and wild mushrooms and chunky tomatoes and a spicy tomato sauce. If you have an espresso at the end, fine. And you think, that was a great meal. But if you look back and think, from my breakfast, my lunch, my dinner, there wasn't any bad fat at all. There were no animal products. There's no animal fat. But it's rich in vegetables and fruits and beans and whole grains.
Okay,
and very, very easy. It's easy to do.
Well, on the subject of diet, I just recently learned about a disease called celiac disease, and in fact, a friend of mine's daughter is suffering from that. I have no idea. Is it gluten intolerance? What is that about?
Yes. Well, luckily, it's rare. Celiac disease is an intestinal disease that affects about 1% of people. And it's caused by gluten, which is a protein that's in wheat, it's in rye, it's in barley. And if you transported yourself into the colon of a person who had celiac disease and you looked at the surface of their intestinal tract, what you see is it looks like a field covered with mud that then got baked in the sun, and it's all cracking, and it's clearly diseased. And there's only one thing to do, and that's to avoid gluten. So that's 1%. About 7% of people have something called gluten intolerance. Their colon looks fine. Their intestinal tract looks fine. However, they don't feel well. They've got intestinal symptoms, and they got fuzzy brain symptoms. And the only way to tell, there's no test for that. The only way to tell if you have gluten intolerance is to avoid gluten.
An elimination.
You just
diet.
Eliminate, see how you feel. But however, very important, avoiding gluten has become a fad. And for 90% of people, it is a complete waste of time. And you can eat spaghetti and you can eat wheat bread perfectly fine. But if you want to try, avoid it for a couple weeks and see how you feel.
I'm Rabia Yaman for The Digital Divide. And today I'm talking with Dr. Neil Barnard, a nutrition researcher, adjunct professor of medicine at George Washington University, and author of the new book, Power Foods for the Brain. Today we're talking about nutrition, memory loss, and how to shield yourself from that. You know, Dr. Barnard, this is progressive radio, so tell me, what is a free radical?
A free radical is not a person carrying a sign. A free radical...
Could be.
It could be. but a free radical is a molecule that started out as, it might have been oxygen, and it got into your blood, and while it was there, it had an electron stolen away from it. And instead of the normal electrons orbiting around the nucleus of the atom, one is gone, or more than one is gone, it becomes unstable, and it wants to get its stability back. So it steals something from another molecule. And it could be, it's like a piranha going around in your blood. And it might take a chunk out of a cell in your skin or in your brain or in your muscles or some other part of the body. Free radicals are really responsible for the aging process. And it occurs in the brain. And what seems to make it worse is, we were talking about iron and copper. Well, if you have a cast iron pan and you leave it on a picnic table for a couple of days, you come back, oh, it's all rusty. If you have a copper penny, as the years go by, it turns dark. This is oxidation. Iron and copper oxidize in your brain too. And so let's say I've been eating meat and liver and I'm getting too much iron, or I've got copper pipes and so I'm getting copper, gets into the brain, oxidizes, releases those free radicals that then destroy the brain cells.
Does eating a diet that's, you know, high in leafy greens and legumes and exercise mitigate? So even if you are using, say, cast iron pans, if you're doing these other things that are beneficial, then can those things still harm you, or how does that work?
Well, I think a couple things should be said. People should not be using cast iron every day. If you're using it once a month, probably no big deal. But for your daily cooking, stainless steel is a better choice. And frankly, people are moving towards steaming and more simpler forms of cooking, so they're not scraping things around in a fry pan in any case. But yes, there are things that you can do that will protect you. Plants are rich in iron, especially green leafy vegetables and also the bean group. I'm cheerleading for greens and beans. You know, beans are a very good food. They've got a lot of protein. They've got iron. They've got calcium.
They have a ton of fiber.
They've got fiber, soluble
tons.
Fiber.
We're and big insoluble. On fiber.
They don't have a good lobby group, but they're good in every way.
They're not sexy.
But they're good in every way, and they have no bad fat. Anyway, the form of iron that is in beans and in greens is called non-heme iron. And the beauty of it is, let's say you're low in iron. You're a little anemic. That form of iron in the plants, it's more absorbable. Let's say you've got too much iron already, and your body is saying, look, I got a lot of iron. I don't need more, because if I get more, it's going to hurt my brain. That non-heme iron in the green leafy vegetables and beans is less absorbable if you already have plenty already. Now, meat is different. Meat has a form of iron called heme iron, a fair amount of this. And that just barges into your party whether it's invited or not. In other words, it's highly absorbable pretty much no matter what. So most Americans have too much iron on board. Why? Because we have a meat-eating country. But if I looked at vegetarians, by and large, they have adequate iron without the excess. These plant products can help you.
You know, we've been hearing for years, and maybe you can help resolve this, if it's an urban rumor or if there's any fact to it, you know, it's the Teflon controversy, nonstick cookware. Where do we stand with it? I've eliminated it in my home, but there were a number of years where I used it. And then finally, I just was too creeped out to use it anymore.
It's especially bad when little chunks of it are scraping off into whatever you're cooking. I'm reading the same reports that you are, and I honestly don't know the answer. I feel like the jury is taking its time.
It seems like eating it is a bad idea.
Yeah. So what I have done is there is some evidence that Teflon is a problem. And there are plenty of other scientists who say, don't worry about it. It's not something to worry about. My own feeling has been to let them fight it out and to not use it. So I don't use it.
Right. Easy enough to find alternative options. And, you know, if there was any risk at all of it, you know, being ingested, I think that anybody would be thinking to themselves, maybe not.
I think that's right. And yet at the same time, I also want people to not think that if they just throw out their Teflon pans, that that's really what they need to do. Because we need to make major changes in the center of our diet. And what I'm saying is, everything that I grew up with eating was really a big mistake. And in other words, meat is something that my family raised for generations, as far back as I can trace. And the less of that you eat, the better off you're going to be. And I feel sort of like the child of a tobacco farmer. You know, they're honest, good people.
Well, you know,
but they got into the business before they knew the problems.
There's a mitigating factor, though, and that is that people were much more physically active at that time than they are now. People are much more sedentary. So if we look at the good old days where, you know, a family maybe had one vehicle and people walked and moved more and had more physical jobs, that level of exercise probably somewhat mitigated, you know, the ingesting of all those. But eating all of these fats and without moving, without heating up our bodies, that's a big problem.
I think exercise really is helpful. At the University of Illinois, they did an interesting study. They brought in a group of people and asked them to exercise. The exercise they did was brisk walking, 10 minutes a day for 3 days a week. Very simple. Anybody could do that. And then they said, next week, let's go 15 minutes. Next week, let's go 20. And they worked them up to 40 minutes, brisk walk, three times a week. At the beginning of the study, and again a year later, they did an MRI of the brain. And they focused in on the part of the brain called the hippocampus, which, by the way, is Latin for seahorse. The people who first teased this out of a cadaver brain, said, doesn't that look like a seahorse? So they're very imaginative. It's a little crescent-shaped organ. But it's the central part of memory. The hippocampus decides when the waiter comes to your table at the restaurant and says, hello, my name is Kelly, the hippocampus says, I don't care, and doesn't bother memorizing that. But things that really count, the hippocampus grabs that, sends it up to the cerebral cortex, measures it. So back at the University of Illinois, the people had been exercising. After a year, they did an MRI and they looked at the hippocampus, other structures in the brain. Instead of gradually shrinking, which is what happens to most people, these memory parts of the brain shrink. They're atrophying bit by bit as we age. For these people, the exercisers, it was growing just slightly year by year. In other words, the exercise gets the oxygen up to the brain, pumps it up, gets the nutrients into the brain, and reverses the age-related shrinkage. So exercise is good. It does help a lot, and it helps. You can demonstrate it not only in the MRIs, but you can do memory testing and you find it's better. Having said that, my grandpa was really physically active and so was my dad. He hitched up a team of horses. My dad did not have a tractor to plow. He hitched up a team of horses and was walking behind the horses plowing the field, very, very physically active. All my grandparents developed these brain diseases. One of my grandparents so died in his early 60s of a heart attack. So exercise is good. But I think of them as separate. You want a healthy diet, you want exercise, right, and you want to not smoke. And a lot of us have done all of these things in the wrong way, including me. And it's good to quit smoking, but exercise doesn't make up for smoking. It doesn't make up for a bad diet. You want to do all of these things. But they all do work together. And they're all a little bit hard because, let's face it, we get addicted to things. And there are reasons why we're attracted to unhealthy. To unhealthy. Well, all, yes. As a matter of fact, we have started to understand why is it that a sugary donut is something that we might crave at certain times when we're angry, when we're lonely. We want that kind of food. We want more of it. We feel bad about it. But nobody has that response to a strawberry. We never binge on them. Why not? We like them, but we don't binge. We have come to understand why. But the point that I'm making is that we have learned that certain foods affect the brain in profound ways. And I believe we can prevent Alzheimer's disease. But our biggest enemies are A, not knowing about it, B, the bad guys, the unhealthy foods, the bacon, the sausage, the cheese. Are, if I can use this word, they're almost addicting, and we now know how what it is they're doing in the body that keeps us hooked. So we need to be able to break away, and if we can do that, we can really solve the world's problems.
What's the next book you're going to write?
Well, I have to say that the next key, once you find out that something is a problem and then getting away from it is an issue, is to find ways to help people to do exactly that. We bring in many, many people into our research offices at the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, which is where I work in Washington, D.C. And they will all say, I want to change my diet, but I am hooked on this or that or the other thing. And we have started to learn that there are several things that help. One is we work as a group. So you're not the lone ranger trying to change your diet all by yourself. So we have, for people who are all by themselves, we have an online program called the Kickstart Program. It's 21 days, 100% vegan, totally healthy, but it's only 21 days so people can do it. You go to our website, which is pcrm.org. You put in your email address, and then for 21 days, you get menus and recipes and pump you up kind of little videos. And you can talk to everyone else who is doing this at the same time.
Is there a fee for this?
No, it's free. No, it's totally free. And we do it in English. We do it in Spanish. We have it in Mandarin. We have one for people of Indian heritage.
Tell us the URL again.
Okay, it's pcrm.org. That stands for Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, pcrm.org. It's totally free, and it's wildly popular because we can only bring in so many people into our offices physically, but I can have 25,000 people doing the online Kickstart. So if you go to pcrm.org, you'll see the Kickstart there, sign up, and the first of every month it starts over again, and you'll get emails from celebrities and how to get on the message board and swap recipes with other people. It changes your life.
Well,
it's really fun.
Well, that's pretty exciting. Thank you so much, Dr. Barnard, for being in the studio today and telling us about your new book, Power Foods for the Brain, and I think folks out there would find it really informative. I found the chapter on vitamins to be really enlightening, because, you know, I just go to the store and I see, you know, a one day vitamin and I think, wow, I have to only take one, and you don't even really have a sense of what's in it. So it's really helpful. Of course, Alzheimer's is at epidemic proportions. We hear a lot about it. I'm really surprised that we don't have more information about the exact causes of it. I think that makes us nervous. For instance, you know, a lot of people wonder if immunizations, you know, if Alzheimer's is residual effect of childhood immunizations. I mean, that we just don't know, but it definitely seems to be something about our environment or what we ingest or put into our body that's affecting us this way.
I think there's no question about it. And the biggest part of the environment, to say the least, is what we're swallowing. Our breakfast, our lunch, our dinner. And we now know enough to take action. The saturated fats, I'm talking meat and cheese and so forth. The trans fats, those are the donuts, get them out. And then bring in the vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, they're vitamin rich, and those are the protectors. Lace up your sneakers. Don't forget to get a good night's sleep. Don't stay up too late. Your memory's going to be good.
Thanks so much, and good luck on your tour.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Neil Barnard on The Digital Divide. Coming up next, Don Jacobson and Moving On.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, June 12th. The controversial law that would close most abortion clinics in the state of Texas will be voted on today in a special session of the Texas State Legislature. Measures approved by committee yesterday will likely lead to the law's passing. The measure bans termination after 20 weeks, changes the requirements for abortion clinics and practitioners. Texas Senator Wendy Davis famously filibustered to prevent the law from passing, but Governor Rick Perry insisted that the law be voted on again in this special session. Both pro-choice and pro-life activists have been on the scene in Austin testifying all week. California prisoners in roughly two-thirds of the state prisons are participating in a hunger strike for better conditions, specifically limiting the time one can spend in solitary confinement. With over 12,400 strikers, it is the largest in that state's history. The last time there was a hunger strike of this magnitude, the head of the state's prison system was poised to acquire court orders to begin force-feeding prisoners. But the strike ended before that happened. A spokesperson with the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Network said that hopefully the massive scale of this strike would push officials to meet the prisoners' demands without too much backlash on the striking prisoners. Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano will be stepping down this